to a series of podcasts brought to you by the Yale Law School.
The Connecticut Supreme Court traveled to Yale Law School on September 12, 2008 to hear arguments in two cases, one criminal and one civil. The court's appearance at Yale Law School is part of an ongoing educational initiative of the Connecticut Judicial Branch called Supreme Court on Circuit. Begun more than 20 years ago, the program seeks to provide students, educators, and the general public with a greater understanding of the court and its procedures. In this podcast, retired Chief Justice Ellen Ash Peters welcomes attendees and discusses the history of the Connecticut Supreme Court.
Whenever I'm here, it feels like being home. And it's great to have a chance to be home. I had, as I now recollect, one class actually in this beautiful auditorium, which was Tax One, taught by a man named Fred Rodell, who really was a wonderful, articulate person who knew nothing about tax. But we all survived. We all passed the bar. I urge you in your career to think about having classes with interesting people and not necessarily worry anything further about your just immediate professional goals. At any rate, I'm delighted to be here this morning. I'm delighted to be here as part of a welcoming committee as you get launched in your legal career. It is true that your curriculum will be different than mine. You will, I'm sure, not have tax in this room. And look, law of contracts has changed, which used to be my principal interest. But whatever it is that you're interested in, whatever you pursue, pursue it in depth, pursue it with passion, and you will have a challenging and exciting and rewarding 3 years. I'm sure that you will love it. This morning, as you know, the Connecticut Supreme Court is sitting here in this beautiful auditorium instead of in Hartford. The Supreme Court sits only in Hartford when it isn't on tour. So please come up to Hartford whenever you are in the neighborhood and come and look at our beautiful courtroom, which is also a wonderful place in which I've had the great pleasure of working for many years. If indeed you want to know whether a good occasion might be to come to Hartford, all of you are more computer literate than I am, and you can easily access what you need to know on the court's calendar. Because Connecticut is such a small state, our state court system is nothing if not flexible. Trial court judges periodically are reassigned to sit anywhere in the state, on any calendar, civil, criminal, family, you name it. Currently, the location where judges most dislike being assigned is Stamford, because you can't get there. Our appellate system is equally open-ended. Typically, appeals start by going to the appellate court, and then there's a certification process to go to the Supreme Court. But that's not a necessary route. Cases can go directly to the Supreme Court, and that's indeed the path that both cases that are being heard today have taken. Administratively, we have the capacity and exercise the capacity to make a preliminary judgment as to whether an issue is sufficiently important that it's likely to go to the Supreme Court anyway, and therefore might just as well bypass the appellate court and go directly, saving time and energy for the parties and expenses as well. You will notice that our court, the court will be sitting in two different panels of five, although as an entirety the court is seven. Except in very difficult, unusually controversial cases, court usually sits as five, and that's a heritage from the days, which is when I started, when there was no appellate court. And one of the ways of getting the business done was to have us divide ourselves as efficiently as possible to dispose of most cases as quickly as possible. So that today that continues to be the case, unless the court decides on its own motion, can be asked by the parties, but basically on its own motion, that it will hear the case in its entirety with seven. As a matter of history, the Connecticut Supreme Court predates the creation of the federal court system. Indeed, our Constitution goes back to the 1600s, predating the federal one in that respect as well. The Connecticut Supreme Court originally was modeled on the British parliamentary plan, so that the upper house of the state legislature was the highest court of the state. Connecticut abandoned that practice just about 200 years ago and formally adopted a constitution with separation of powers in 1818. Great Britain, as you know, has had Parliament through the House of Lords sitting as the highest court until very, very recently. Our good experience has finally gone across the Atlantic. Each of the present judges, like every other judge in the state other than probate judges, was nominated by the governor and appointed to his or her office by the General Assembly for a renewable 8-year term of office. Happily for all of us, at least, there are no elected Superior Court or Supreme Court judges in the state. No judge in this state has the obligation of raising $N million, where N is a very large number, in order to be able to assume office. The downside is that we do have constitutionally a mandatory retirement age of 70, so that in Associate Justice Barry Schaller, a graduate of this law school, will not be able to serve out his full 8-year term because he will hit that age of 70 before too long. We have something incredibly anomalous, which is not worthwhile talking about at length today, which enables me to sit on the appellate court as a judge, even though I'm constitutionally incapable for some other purposes. You don't want to know how that works. One point, I don't want to know how it works because I want to be able to continue to sit. Before oral argument, each member of our Supreme Court, you can count on this, has engaged in considerable study of the briefs and the records of the case to be heard. Our court is known as a hot court, in which oral argument belongs to the justices. It's an opportunity for the justices to ask pointed questions, to clarify the issues that they want clarified, and to sharpen the points that they want to hear about. Experienced appellate counsel, as you will hear here, are fully prepared for the reality that the half hour which is nominally assigned to them is really an opportunity for the court to quiz them and to get a better sense as to what the issues of the court before the court really are. Inexperienced counsel who prepare set speeches have the unhappy experience regularly of being told within 2 minutes max, that's very interesting, counsel, but would you be kind enough to enlighten me on, etc. All of the counsel whom you will hear today are fully familiar with how the court operates and understand that it's really the last good opportunity to have a sensible, meaningful conversation between the court and those who want to persuade the court of the wisdom of their arguments. So what's an issue on appeal? I take it even though you were just starting in law school recognize an appeal is not a retrial. Although the official record on appeal normally includes a transcript, nowadays usually on a disc, there are no live witnesses here today, and there will be none. It's not just that they're hiding somewhere with the court. The litigants may be present, but only as spectators and not as participants. They will not be heard unless they are appearing without counsel, pro se, on the whole, not the preferred way to address a hot court. It's the lawyers who present the appeal. The corollary to that principle is, at least in criminal cases, that the issues before the court are largely limited to issues of law and not of fact. Appellate courts do not review actual fact findings of innocence or guilt for a very simple reason. Juries do not make factual findings of guilt or innocence in a criminal case. They deliver a verdict. The verdict is guilty or not guilty of a particular crime, some or all of the crimes with which a defendant has been charged, but there are no findings of fact. In theory, a criminal defendant has an option to be tried not by the jury, but by the court. And courts, of course, judges, they do make findings of fact. That's their stock and trade. Interesting fact, and something you may want to reflect on from time to time, is that experienced criminal attorneys almost never advise their clients to do that, to have a trial by the court rather than by the jury. Indeed, the American faith in the jury system with its minuses as well as its pluses, is one of the features of our jurisprudence that distinguishes us from just about every other legal system on this earth. And it's interesting when you think about it, particularly under our new Chief Justice, whom you will see shortly, transparency in criminal proceedings has come to be very high on our judicial administrative agenda. We think it's important for everyone to be able to understand what's going on in a courtroom and what's going on in the ways in which the court system tries to deliver on its mission of providing justice. Surprisingly, with that mission, to which everyone subscribes in principle, we are not troubled by the fact that jury verdicts, in some sense, can be called something like what astrophysicists call a black hole. We know what goes in, but we know very little about what comes out. So on appeal, because we're unable to review jury findings of fact because there aren't any. And so by default, the criminal appeal focuses on rulings of law by the trial court judge, and those, of course, are on the record, and they are decisions about such matters as admissibility of evidence and jury instructions. Well, the result of all of that is that the appellate process focuses on the input rather than the output of jury deliberations. One consequence of this shift, in one might have thought a natural agenda, is that criminal appeals particularly are often highly technical. This morning's case involves what can only be described as murderous encounters of two or more people who are in the illicit business of selling cocaine. There are many arguments about whether cocaine should or should not be legitimately available, and perhaps one of them is when it is a hidden product and involves a great deal of money, it lends itself to the kind of turf wars which can be extraordinarily lethal, as they were in this case. What we have, though, in this case is no discussion by any of the parties. I've looked at the briefs. I'm not reliably on every nuance, but believe me, the briefs do not focus upon what happened to the various people involved in this drug business. The brief focuses instead on something called a nolle, criminal information when it's dismissed with or without prejudice. Those are very difficult, complex legal issues. And of course, in a larger sense, they relate to guilt and innocence, but really only in a very larger sense. The other consequence of the way that the criminal process is structured is that a great deal of energy is devoted on appeal to the question of whether the trial judge, whose rulings are reviewable because they are of record and they're available for us to look at, whether those rulings encompassed the issue that the appellant now wants to present to the Supreme Court or the appellate court on review. By and large, we do not review issues that were not presented at trial. And that, too, raises some issues of policy that are troublesome, particularly if someone is going to be in prison for 80 years plus or minus, and mostly plus. It follows, then, that in criminal cases, the governing law is what one might call lawyer's law. We barely, almost never, concern themselves directly with questions relating to actual innocence. It's true that the Warren Court, the Warren Supreme Court of the United States, interjected a whole series of federal constitutional considerations into our state law so that the breadth of criminal procedure issues is considerably more encompassing than it was when I was in law school. But the underlying reality hasn't really been changed by the Warren Court. And so we have, with some unease, the specter that we see DNA evidence many years after someone has been convicted on a record which seems to meet all of the legal requirements of an appropriate trial, and yet we have falsely accused, falsely convicted criminal defendants, with, until there was DNA, very little opportunity really to mount an effective challenge on issues of guilt and innocence. I don't mean to say with this emphasis that there's something wrong with lawyers' law or legal issues that are intricate and professional and infinitely challenging. They are. They're much of what you need to learn as lawyers. They have much of what you need to be exceptionally good at dealing with as lawyers. It's intellectually challenging and rewarding to become an excellent lawyer. Still, as you proceed through your legal training, I would suggest that you may want to keep a critical eye on the institutional assumptions within which our courts and our lawyers discharge their serious responsibilities. During my tenure as Chief Justice, one of my very distinguished colleagues at the Supreme Court would sometimes grumble at conferences. My God, he would say, "You can't make new law every day." And the answer to that is probably not. You're probably right about that. We were hardly doing it every day, but past that. It would, however, it struck me then and continues to strike me now, I suppose, it would have been infinitely worse if we had never made new law. Courts need lawyers to point the way, not only within the confines of the issues that have been historically placed before the court, but also with an eye toward developing new issues and a new critical judgment as to whether the court is being presented with all of the issues and all of the concerns that a fair and just legal system is all about. I challenge all of you. We need to have from all of you as you come through the law school, as you graduate and become members of our profession, new questions for us to answer and new insights for the way we ought to think about our trials. We have to count on you to do it because we're so set in our ways because that's what we've been doing. The challenge of the Yale Law School in particular, and every good law school, is to carve out new paths, to think about new challenges so that our law will indeed meet the requirements all of us place on the law of having a just legal system. I thank you.